The SoCal Sound Sessions are listener and member supported. Please consider becoming a subscribing member. Click subscribe now at the top of the SoCalSound.org and make sure to choose live sessions from the drop-down menu.
I'm Nick Harcourt, and we are here at the Sunset Marquee in Hollywood. Last time we were here, we interviewed Ringo Starr, which was a blast. Today, it's David Gray. How you doing?
You've been downgraded.
Did you bring your drumsticks?
No, but I'm looking at Tina Turner on the wall and thinking I must try harder with my stage outfit.
Well, you're looking very sharp today. Thank you for dressing up for us.
Yeah.
Obviously, there's a new album, Dear Life, which we want to talk about. But I also want to talk a little bit about how, I mean, you've had a career that has sort of been independent with labels, independent, licensing to labels, independent, and now you are fully independent in every sense of the word. And I know it sort of started with the last album,
I'm hearing Gloria Gaynor suddenly.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm in a state of independence. So, as you say, I've done it every which way, really. I was on major labels to begin with, and then we went solo with White Ladder, and then licensed that to the majors, Sony here and Warner's everywhere else. We've had deals with Universal, like short-term deals, and then for a long time been going through the AWOL sort of Cobalt system, and now I've gone with Secretly as my distributor. But yes, I've got a new record label. It's all the complicated history of the recordings and the relationships, and I've moved on. So my old manager and I had the record company that owned the catalogue from right. White Ladder till Golden, the Brass Age. And the best way out of stopping working together was to sell the catalogue and resolve things in that way. So now I've started my own company, Laugh a Minute Records. It was a quip, really, that's why the company's called that. Because it was everything but a laugh at the time I said it. So now I'm standing on my own two feet in another way and loving it. I'm loving the sense of freedom I have and to be on the other side of all that stuff. And I don't mean just the negatives of when relationships wear out or whatever. I think that I've come through everything from starting your career to the success, all the sort of awkward phases. I've kind of negotiated the rapids to a great extent, and now I've kind of come to terms with that, and I've got a real positive attitude, positive energy about what I'm doing and the finite amount of time I have to accomplish it in. So this is a fresh start, and it's fun. But I mean, it's the industry shifts so fast and so profoundly that it never gets any easier. It's even if you make better and better work, it doesn't mean anything. It's not a meritocracy. It works along different lines. So there's always a new way that you have to negotiate to kind of get across, get through, get the message out. So I think being an independent, it is hard. There's just a ridiculous onslaught of music. You hope that relationships that you have in the industry will mean something. And the quality of what you're doing will mean something. But people retire, and if I'm 56, the people who are playing my records on record stations were in their 60s.
Shush, quiet.
So they're all, they're, it's like, where's, oh he's gone, right? Or she's gone.
Well, they're dead, yeah.
So yeah, it's like that. So it constantly changes, but one thing that's constant is you just have to make the best music you possibly can.
Right. At the end of the day, it's always going to come down to the songs. You know, I was thinking as you were just talking about that, we've spoken many times through the years, and I remember when you came into my old gig with White Ladder, before it got picked up, it was still, I think you had a publishing deal and we had a Chrysalis version of the record or something. And I remember you coming in and talking about that record because you didn't have a deal, and you were talking about the freedom that you had to make that record, because I think, if I remember correctly, you told me you weren't sure you'd ever get a chance to make another one. And at that time, you just took a chance in how you recorded it. And I'm wondering, as you're approaching the records today and this new record, if there's something similar in that freedom where you're not really worrying about what somebody's going to say about, is there a hit single on it?
I think the comparison I'd probably choose to make between the White Ladder scenario which is, I guess, the David Gray template, where it's that it was a backs against the wall moment because no one was interested in putting a new record out. And whether I knew it in my conscious mind or it was just an unconscious thing, I knew that the music had to lean out and make contact. It had to be direct. So there's a directness to that record, the melodies and the way that it just reaches, and it's very heart on sleeve. So I think through all the trials and tribulations of recent years and the changes to my structure, as we've just talked about, like ending up on my own label, Skellig I put out on this label, but that was a very different thing during lockdown, and a record that was never going to have aspirations to be a radio record or anything like that. But this record has a directness to it, and I think it's the same thing. I think that it's like an In Rainbows moment, whether Radiohead knew it or not. When they were placed in that position, when they were going their own way, they made a record that was really instant. You know, it was high quality, interesting. It had, it ticked all the boxes as well, but it had this immediacy to it. So and that's what I feel that Dear Life has. I feel it has a real directness, straight to camera is the kind of the way I sort of talk about the writing on it. It's very engaging, whereas I can be kind of more obtuse or interior or, you know, less obvious. It's much more reliance on narrative and sort of very direct storytelling, which I guess sometimes I avoid. But I think more than just the melodic sense of it, the directness of it, it feels very engaging to me and very immediate. So when I said it to the bands, I said, these songs are sort of born standing up. You know, we can put them alongside these other things and they're going to hold their ground. Whereas I wouldn't go out and play Skellig amongst, you know, Sail Away and Please Forgive Me. It would be a bit of a battle trying to do that. But these songs feel like they have the sort of musculature, if you like. They can kind of hold their own.
So you talk about the narrative in the songs. Can you tell us about a couple of the songs that you're going to play for us and where they came from?
Yeah, well, After the Harvest, I'll definitely play. And that, it leads off the record because it's the track one, because it has a, it's somewhere I haven't been before. The way I deliver it, the lyric is almost rap. It's very fast delivery. It has these joyful rhyming schemes that just, and it kind of, as soon as it landed, I thought, yeah, I've just not been here before. I've never been in this particular musical space.
Had you ever tried to be in that musical
space? No, this is just what happened. The weird conjunction of ideas, but really it was this rhyming scheme and this very fast vocal. It's over a 6/8, so the song's in 6/8, but you wouldn't read it as such necessarily until you get to the chorus, where it goes into kind of, it comes out of double time, if you like, and slows down, and you go, oh right, I see, 1 2 3 1 2 3. So but yeah, just the way that Clune put the drums into it, so it just has a, it sounds like it's got its feet in the contemporary world of music, and yet it's like a tried and tested. It feels very like me as well, like very much so. So it has a very, very strong identity. But yeah, I so enjoyed the writing of it. I mean, ditto for this whole record, I had a wonderful time writing. The lyrics are the hardest thing to achieve, you know, really. And I just got into such a flow this time. And the enjoyment, even if the subject is dark, I think the reason that the record can sort of touch so many kind of weighty subjects, if you like, mortality, crisis, kind of emotional estrangement or whatever, there's always a humor and a lightness. The way that the lyrics fell and the imagery came, it just helps to put those kind of ideas across. It's not angst ridden when you're listening to it. So I think it's a good song to, After the Harvest is a good song to focus on, because I also used a kind of short story writer's trick. Dear Life, I like as an album title because it's got different ways that you can read it. It could be Life, a Cherished Thing, or A Letter to Life, or Clinging On for Dear Life, which is one of the lines on the record. But it's also a tribute to Alice Munro, who's one of my favorite short story writers. And I used a kind of short story writing trick. It's nothing new. I use this in my writing all the time, like an imaginative leap where I mean, After the Harvest is definitely from an older woman's perspective. So the kids have gone, the relationship's over. She's, to all intents and purposes, sort of invisible in the world that remains. She's not a sort of desirable entity. So I used that as an imaginative place to write from. And on subsequent songs across the record, and some of the ones that didn't make it onto the record, I used the same thing. So Sunlight on Water would be an answering song from a male perspective. So so that's After the Harvest. It has an interesting rhythmic construction powered by the sort of dynamo of this vocal. But the rhyming was such fun. The joy of words, the magic of words. I mean, words have magic properties. We've forgotten that they were all incantations when they were born. They were the naming of sacred and magic things that could only be spoken by the shaman or whatever. So they've become so used and abused. We don't see their magic properties, and yet, like chemistry, when you put the right words together in the right setting, they can have a very magic effect. So, I mean, obviously, I devote my life to trying to create that effect. but it just flowed this time. So After the Harvest is definitely pick one.
Days like empty fields after the harvest, this ache where the heart is. Like a tree that's bare, in the sky that's starless, like something out of place. Feel all used up, feel tarnished, like smudged eyeliner, chip nail varnish, like something scarcely visible, garnish with a face. Think I might be done with this final strawness. Pick your heart back up off the floorness. This less but certainly not monus. This bitter aftertaste. This run right down to the corners. This beat your fist on the doorness. This minus, this yawnus. Well, in any case, I know that love is bigger than this door. Scraps out in the melee. Tell me I got this turned around the wrong way. Tell me I got it mixed up in my head. Feels like I'm left here standing on the runway. A fleeting thought that barely registers. So imagine gazing up great dispassionate eyes that observe us, head slightly tilted to one side the way a bird does, staring quizzically at all our silly little lies, our absurd loves are scratching at the surface, clowns throwing custard pies in the circus of our vanity. I know that love is bigger than this great. Scraps out in the melee. Maybe I should know better than to take it personally. When the hand that wrote the love letter decides to write you out the story, turned around the wrong way. Could be I got it mixed up in my head. Feels like I'm left here standing on the runway. A fleeting thought that barely registers. And now the I want this as I stand here astonished, scraping off the filth, cutting away the stifling bodice underneath the brand new skin like a goddess. Words forming on my lips like a promise to myself.
So you mentioned dear life as being something that can have multiple meanings.
Yeah.
Is that a place where you're at in your life right now? I don't want to pry, but are you relating to, you know, growing older?
Of course. Yeah. You know, I'm at the age now that my father was when he called me and told me he had basically, you know, terminal cancer. So he was dead when he was 57 in 2 months. And I'll have crossed that invisible line in approximately 6 months' time.
Is that something that you've had on your mind all your life?
I think it is going to be, because it was a life-changing event. So, you know, it changed my perspective on life entirely. And as I get closer, it seems ridiculous that he was my age when he died. I'm like, what? You know, yeah, so that definitely, I mean, I think the idea that when you're settled and married and older, life is sort of resolved is a false one.
No shit. No shit. I got a couple of years on you. And yeah. How many lives can you live within one lifetime?
So I think that it's always up for grabs. And I think that's the power of our genes. I think that's a sort of genetic driver. I think we're looking to survive ultimately and pass on our genes into the future. Part of you is always assessing what the best options are. So I think that, yes, there's a certain weathering process that takes place. And yeah, so things fall in and out of feeling okay and then not okay, and different people drift off. And so, yeah, I mean, my life has been, well, as I said, when Rob Holden, my first manager, discovered me, I was nobody. I was an art student in Liverpool with a band, and we'd made our first demo. And then we went on a crazy adventure together. So it was more than managerial. It extended into intense friendship, love, devotion. It encompassed so many incredible things and shared experiences and memories that no one else will share with me. So when that came to an end, as it inevitably did, it was a lot to come to terms with. It's not an easy thing to resolve. It was like a marriage.
Yeah, it's like another marriage.
It is, yeah. So so that was very turbulent and difficult. And Dear Life was made within that and then on the other side of that. So, I've lost friends and there's been lots going on. There was, as you get older, there's more and more of that stuff. So, and the sense of things being finite is... It sharpens the flavors of life. I mean, this tour that I'm doing is about my love for my band, really. I mean, they are the flesh of my music. And Neil McCall's very ill at the moment. He couldn't come on the tour. He's got a cancer diagnosis and he's being treated in London at the moment. So even before we've got on the tour, the words that I said 12 months ago to everyone, which is, we're going to do this while we still can, as in, I'm going to push you further than you think you can go. So they've learned like 75 songs for this trip.
Wow.
We're up to 60 something already that we've played in the first however many shows. So it's not just looking through the new album and playing the big songs from the past. We're going deep into older albums, playing sort of deep cuts off lost songs, Century Ends, you name it. Because I know that they can, and they kind of hold the music in them like I hold it in me. And it's suddenly like, well, like they're family as well. We are a strange, dysfunctional family on a tour bus. So that's a part of things too. So I think there's a lot of turning around and sort of, and I feel very fortunate. But to have all these people and all these things, anyway, there's a part of the record, I think, has this flavor of coming to terms with things as well, maybe.
Is that the overriding feeling that I would get as a listener if I
think it's more like
took the journey?
It's more crisis. There's more crisis and loss and sort of planetary perspectives. It's like a microscope telescope system. So I'm focusing in very intensely on detail and imagery. And then there's these kind of sort of James Webb Space Telescope kind of views that kind of come wrap around the whole thing as well. So I think it's a mixture of the two things. So, but yes, I mean, just in terms of the sort of subtext of why the record came out a certain way, there's been a lot of ups and downs and goodbyes of lots of different kinds. And I'm approaching this invisible line, which I think is significant in my mind. Anyway.
With your father's.
Yeah. So I think all that does play into it. But just being older and just having a different view of the mountain that we're all sort of supposedly trying to climb to the top of.
So what's the view look like today?
Well, I mean, it looks good. I'm enjoying life, I think, as much as I ever have. I think, as I say, I think that it's like time is like seasoning sometimes. In terms of living in the moment and sort of emotional presence, I feel that I'm really here. Like, I'm not thinking of the next gig while I'm playing this one. I'm here. I'm enjoying it all. I'm taking it all in, and I'm available for my band, for the people around me, my crew, and for the audience, most importantly of all. So, I think I've got a good bigger picture perspective. So, you know, not that I'm trying to cozy up to anyone, but it's just, I want it to be a kind of, it's got to have this emotional component. So that's how it feels to me at the moment. I mean, I'm not talking about the world. It's hard to engage with how that looks, which is bleak. So, incredibly, cynical, or age of cynicism and brutalism and sort of narcissism nicely combined. But there's nothing new there. We just have the sort of technology to extend the reach of idiocy, it seems. And we're doing a damn fine job of it. So it's depressing when you look out. And that does touch onto this record. Of course it does. I mean, these songs are situated within the world. So it's pressing on these characters and these ideas.
I have a note on my desk. I put it on last year sometime when I was in that moment of awareness of time not being infinite for individuals. And it just says time. And as I'm sitting there doing my work every now and then, I just see this note and it just says time. Just to remind me that as I'm, you know, participating in this life, that there is only so much time. And it seems to be that that's tying into your father's passing, obviously, around the age you are now. And I'm wondering, do you feel that once you pass that, things might shift a little bit for you?
I
ask you this because I had a very good friend many years ago when I lived in Woodstock, whose father passed away 50 or something like that. And he was freaking out for so long that this was something. And then, like, it came and it passed and it kind of left him.
Yeah, I don't think I'm obsessed with it. I'm just...
aware.
Curious.
Yeah.
And it seems strange to reflect, you know, 20 however many years on, that this is what was happening in his life at this time, and measuring that time between us. It's, you know, like, this is how old the difference in time between him dying and me reaching that age is the difference in our ages. So it's a sort of measuring stick in so many ways. But yeah, I mean, it's definitely a part of things. I mean, I've got kids and they're growing up and they're doing their thing as well. So that's another sort of area of enrichment and challenge that's part of things to do. We're trying to accommodate all this different stuff into a creative life isn't easy.
Can you tell us about the song that you're going to play for us, Eyes Made Rain?
Yeah, Eyes Made Rain. It's very simple. And in my younger demographic, the only people I have contact with being my daughters and a few friends, and they're, you know, friends, children of friends of mine.
How old is this age group?
So early 20s, okay. Late teen. The Eyes Made Rain is the song that they seem to gravitate towards. So if I were to decode, it's not a real lyrical flight. It's more just a mood with a sort of mantric idea that turns as the chorus, Eyes Made Rain. I sort of see a kind of, vaguely see Picasso's Weeping Woman as kind of like, but the idea of shedding so many tears that it's like a rain, a deluge. So personal loss, relationship loss, and ultimately sort of societal, planetary loss. I think they all bind into the idea. But the lyric was hazy. It was a mood I created with the guitar. And as soon as we began to work on this track, it was instantly different. And I almost, that all I needed to do was hang images like a mobile inside, reflect just enough light in the right way to move the song through. So sometimes I'll have an initial vocal that I put down and that will just get taken away and I'll end up writing the whole thing. But in this, I actually just extended or modified my whatever unconscious response, if you like. So it's not written as formally as a lot of the other songs on the record, but it has a delicacy to it. So when I play it on my own, it stands up, as do all the records on the songs on this new album. I can play them all on either a keyboard or on the guitar. So this is a very simple song, essentially.
What's the demographic you're talking about, your kids and their friends, or you know, kids between 18 and mid-20s or whatever? What's their response to that song? How do they feel it?
I don't know. I just keep hearing that it's their favorite. So it's my daughter's favorite on the new record. And then it's her friend's favorite. And then I just saw a friend of, the son of another friend of mine who's living in San Francisco. And he said his favorite is Eyes Made Rain. The fact that these people are even listening to my music is double thumbs up. Yeah, so that's the sort of early 20s, late teens type people.
All right. Gotta get them while they're young.
Exactly.
Chasing shadows, chasing sweet catastrophe. Something in here shattered by that soft refrain. Our eyes made rain. Our eyes made rain. Way back to the garden, found it boarded up. And I heard my own voice shouting, do you not know when to stop? 'cause it's gone and we won't ever see its like again. So our eyes made rain, our eyes made rain, our eyes made rain. Reach one out and gather one, tie the knot and tether one, ever to remain. Stretch one out and cover one, push one, pull the other one, no two hearts the same. Through all this time and never once to truly see the sanctity we did profane. Our eyes made rain, our eyes made. With the daylight stark upon me now, I'm full awake. Got my spirit taking measure of everything we did forsake. Something in here triggered by that soft refrain. Well, my eyes made rain, my eyes made rain, my eyes made rain, my eyes made.
We're talking about some of the songs that are on the record that you're playing for us, and that day must surely come. How did that one kick off?
Well, I think in every writing process, there's a moment, I hope, each time when a song sort of falls out the sky, and That Day Must Surely Come was that song this time. So I was working on something completely different, and I just accidentally extended my chord up and I thought, oh, that's nice. And then I came back down again. I thought, I've never played that before. And then I just started to pick this little rhythm. And the first line came and I thought, hang on a minute, push that song to one side, I'm working on this. And then I wrote it over the course of the next hour or two. And it's an extraordinary experience because it's as if there's something inside you that's been waiting to be born. And it announces that this is the moment it's going to be born, and it's born complete lyrics. It's a very simple song, so it's not like I've created a sort of giant opus of immense complexity, but in terms of, it's just a very simple chordal frame on which to hang the ideas. And this is very much a sort of mortality drift. So it's a song about reckoning. The lyrics just poured out. I mean, in these moments, I guess people call them inspiration. I think what separates the and they're rare. I mean, as I say, if it happens to me once every album cycle, I'll take that. But, and that's not to say other songs aren't written quickly, but that's not quite what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the almost uncanny experience of something. You sense that this, it's almost like it's ready. The whole thing is going to land. And the depth with which the imagery is dredged up from surprises you, overwhelms you. So you have this incredible emotional response. You realize you're saying things you've sort of dreamt of saying or thought of saying in a thousand ways over I don't know how many years. And that's what the experience was like. It's like the walls that normally separate you from all the sweets in the sweet shop fall and you've got access to everything. Like it's a free for all, lyric wise, emotion wise. Your reach is just unimpeded. And so you have, but it's this intensely subjective experience. You get, I got incredibly emotional. I had hairs on the back of my neck, on my arms at times, and I had tears in my eyes writing it. And then at the same time, you have the kind of the drone goes up, the sort of editorial view, and you make incredibly clear decisions about what you need and what you don't. That's too much. That sounds, that's over the top. I don't need that verse. Don't bother finishing it. This is enough. So you make very clear decisions and move yourself on in quick time. And so I wrote the song, as I say, in a matter of hours. It was complete. And then when I next saw my producer, I just said, I've got a new song, I want to record this. And same thing, I just said, look, I've got a rhythm, I'll sing you a rhythm. So I said, record me singing a rhythm. So give me a click. Okay, yeah, that'll do. And I sang a rhythm in and we kind of processed that. So it sounded a bit like a drum beat. And then I just basically recorded the guitar and then recorded the vocal and that was it. And then we put a few bits onto it and was basically done in a couple of hours. It was very, very, very fast. And we have tinkered with it in finishing the record, but essentially 90% of what's there was done in this short burst. And I knew it, I just knew it was special. So yeah, I think sometimes you can reach a bit further. And that was the moment this time round. So yeah, it's a song that it doesn't fail to stop the audience in their tracks. It stops me in my tracks. So it's a powerful thing. It's understated, but there's nothing better on the record. Sunlight and Water and That Day Must Surely Come sit in the very center of the album. And they are the sort of gravitational center. It's almost like you arrive at them and then you are at the center of this new record. So, yeah, anyway, that's it.
Well, it's always a pleasure to spend a little bit of time with you. Thank you for dressing up for me. I appreciate it. And David Gray's new album is called Dear Life. And he's been performing for us and chatting about the new record on the morning show on the SoCal Sound. Thanks so much.
Nice one, Nick.
Cheers, mate.
I've been hiding for so long. How I stole that bliss, knowing full well that it was wrong. No, didn't need no pencil and paper to the song. Sailing around this river bend in a whole lifetime. Oh, such a long time to pretend. She stands before us, dark as a forest, ripe as a plum. Chest to show my tongue can not be bought when all this world is made flesh. How is this mouth there to kiss a thought? Lump in my throat, hanging this note over the strum. Fully answering bright. Blood smelly fires, oh, all crackling. Let sorrow choke on wine and smoke, vodka and rum. Know that day must surely come. I can still feel the shock when, as a child, for the first time, saw the great void unlocked and understood then it would be mine. No trumpet blast, no champagne glass, no roll on the drum. No, but that day must surely come. For lavish praise, some clothe themselves in brittle shell, some choose to spend their days damning the whole thing. All the hell, go west, go east, take most, take least, feast on the crumb. But know that day must surely come. You know that day must surely come.
The SoCal Sound Sessions are produced by 88.5 The SoCal Sound. Session hosted by Nick Harcourt. Audio recorded and mixed by Tristan Dolce. Edited by Matt Blake. The SoCal Sound is a public service of California State University Northridge and Saddleback College. Streaming on the web at thesocalsound.org.